Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Welcome to Undriven on Joy 94.9 with your hosts Kafam and Hugh. Kafam, tonight we have a good friend of mine called Ravi Lula.
Lula, that sounds Lula. Pretty draggy, doesn't it?
Yeah, Ravi is a counsellor at Melbourne University and originally comes from Mumbai in India. He did spend a few years in Hong Kong, and he met his very nice partner there as well. And he's now moved to Melbourne, and we've got a great show coming up tonight.
And of course, Ravi has brought along his music selection as well. That's what we do normally. Mm.
And it's all linked to his story.
So. And he also brought some canto pop as well, as far as I know.
Okay.
No canto pop?
No.
He's shaking his head.
Just before we go into the show, though, if you'd like to comment, as we said earlier on tonight's show, you can call Nick on reception on 96992-9249.
You may continue.
Thank you. And after this, we'll be talking to Ravi. Welcome to Undriven on Joy 94.9 with Kafam and Hugh. And our guest tonight is Ravi. Ravi, welcome to Orange Driven.
And Ravi, that song you brought in and you ask us specifically to remind you, or you're going to get pissed off. Tell us, why would you get pissed off?
I would get pissed off because that song was dedicated to my boyfriend, Peter, who's right now in LA, and I miss him and I hate him. I hate him because he hasn't messaged me, and this has been going on now for the last 15 years.
Oh, he never messages you.
Once in a while, and then I tell him that.
I will say that the reason he's in LA is for his job. He's an air steward, isn't he?
That's right. He works. Okay. He's a trolley dolly working in Qantas.
Right. It's not as if he just left you alone and.
But he can message me.
Now, Ravi, as I said, welcome to the show. Just to start the show off, let us know a little bit about you. Where do you come from?
I come from India. And a city called Mumbai, but I also grew up in South India, which is a place called Coimbatore.
Okay. And your time in Mumbai, how long were you there?
Seems like the whole of my life, actually. Probably one-third of my life. I did my schooling there and till my high school.
Okay.
And then I went to Coimbatore, where I did my high school and my first degree, which I hated, which was economics. And then I came back to Mumbai to do something which I had no idea what it meant, but it was something called medical and psychiatric social work.
Okay.
And I've been a social worker all my life after that.
Okay. Now, your background, though, your background is Sindhi Hindu, is that right?
That's right.
What's a Sindhi?
Sindhi by state means that all Sindhis, it's a state in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where all Sindhis came from. However, most Hindus moved from Pakistan to India before the partition. So I was born in Bombay, but my parents, sorry, Mumbai, my parents were born in Pakistan.
Oh, okay.
So the Hindus from Pakistan moved back to India.
That's right.
And they are called the Sindhis. And they are quite different culturally and language-wise?
Culture and language-wise, it is probably one of the oldest civilizations in around. There's a place called Mohenjo-Daro, which dates back thousands of years. I have no idea, but that's what my father tells me.
Okay.
Have you been to Mohenjo-Daro?
I haven't been to Pakistan. Forget about Mohenjo-Daro.
Because we studied that at school, Mohenjo-Daro. Mm. The statues over there are quite promiscuous and very liberal, isn't it?
I think so. I've also studied that in school.
Just in textbook.
That's right.
So tell us a little bit about your life, you know, growing up in India. What type of schooling?
Growing up was very difficult after 15, 16 because, one day I discovered I like guys.
Okay.
And it was funny because India is one of the most difficult states because you can attract it to guys. You can have even sex with guys in the night, but in the morning, you're friends.
Okay.
So it was confusing, it was difficult, but also at some point one needs to work with it. So I enjoyed it and I still miss India.
Mm. So at what age did you realize you were gay?
Probably when I was 9.
9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that affect you?
I didn't, there was a bit of a terror going on inside my head, which was that I didn't want to be gay, which is a very horrible thing to say, and especially in Western culture where if you say that, you get into trouble. But because Asian cultures generally look at the family, there was no set identity called a relationship, and it wasn't just sex which I was
but
after.
But it's quite normal for young children to not understand it for a start.
I understood it.
You understood it.
Yeah.
Okay. But not accepted.
I accepted it, but society didn't accept it. So it wasn't because I didn't want to marry the first guy I fell in love with and be with him for the rest of my life. It was because if I said that to him, he would beat me black and blue, and my mother and my father would not like talk to me.
So you said you understood it. So does it mean that you are aware that there are other people like yourself out there?
Yes.
At 9 years old.
Sorry?
At 9 years old,
I wanted to marry somebody I loved.
A guy. Okay. When did you sort of talk to people about this song?
Oh, very late. Probably when I was 26 or 27, when I met a group called the Hamsafar Trust, which started the first gay magazine called the Bombay Dost.
Mm.
I applied there for a job. And I was a social worker, and by the way, I wasn't gay.
That's what you told them.
Yeah, this is what I mean. Even though you realized at 9 years old,
that's right,
you were denying it, weren't you?
I wasn't denying it. I was terrified.
Hmm.
The fear was paralyzing, and at the end of the day, it was just about working. And by the way, these people loved me. They accepted me unconditionally, and they threw me out of India. They said, you'd be better out going to somewhere else. That's why I left to Hong Kong at 29, because I would either have to get married or basically come up with what I was.
So when you first moved in there, you told everyone, I'm not gay.
Mm-hmm.
But towards the end, perhaps, or the middle, you would have, you know...
They just loved me unconditionally. There's a guy called Ashok Rao Kavi. He was a prominent gay activist there. And he just told me, darling, we love you. Whatever you are. Just not worry about it.
But so they know, of course.
Of course they knew.
When did you tell your parents?
When I was in a strong relationship, the relationship was very, very... But most Asian people are not really worried about the gay part. They're worried about the fact that you'll settle down with somebody. So when I've actually settled down with Peter, that's when I told my mother and my sister.
How old were you then?
33, 34. So it was 3-4 years in the relationship.
Okay, and they had no idea up until this point that you were gay.
Ah, come on. They had a fair inclination. I was bringing strange guys nobody knew, and I was bringing them every week.
You took them home.
That's right.
But isn't it common in India to bring friends whom have sleepovers?
Not people you don't know, they haven't met. And next day morning, we get coffee from mom, and she says, oh, hello, how are you?
So she met all your boyfriends or your...
She met my one-night
boyfriend. Stands. Yeah, one-night stands. Yeah.
Surely you would have said, this guy, I know him from college or tuition classes or...
Some story. There's always a story. But mom definitely knew something was going on, but they don't want to know.
And, you know, because coming out is, I believe, is a very Western concept. Would you say it's quite applicable in Asian countries to come out? Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
We did... I'm still part of Hamsafar Trust, and we did a conference with regards to same-sex relationships, and we had about 50 different views of what gay was.
Mm.
And so, you know, so it was very complex in the sense that each culture within India itself didn't know what it meant. So the basic thing was men who have sex with men and men who love men, which was the other one. We love men, or men, women who love women.
So... Peter, who's your partner just now, he was the first person you would call your partner?
Yes.
Right. And how long have you been with Peter?
15 years.
That's a long time.
It feels like that, but then again, right now, when he's not around, it feels forever.
Of course, but he's away all the time, you know, flying off to different countries.
Usually 2 to 3 days, but a flight to America takes a week, so that's a little long.
Okay.
So after 15 years, you still miss him terribly. I think that's terribly romantic.
It is, but we love and hate. So when he's around, we probably go back to, you know, some level of sulking or whatever it is in a relationship.
Is Peter aware that, you know, you're on the show right now? Is he listening?
He's in America. He is aware that I am going for this show.
He's probably up in the air somewhere. Flying
he's
around.
Probably in somewhere going to Las Vegas and having fun, something. I'm jealous, sorry.
He's also upset because Peter hasn't phoned him tonight.
And so, but then thereafter in India, moving a bit forward, and you left India with $500 and a plane ticket to Hong Kong.
That's right. I'll make the story short. I had a friend of mine who came from India who lived in Hong Kong and literally stayed in my bed for 6 months.
And, oh, shared a bed.
Yeah, because he had a fight with his girlfriend. So I got them married just to get him out of my bed. And so he went back to Hong Kong and kept calling me and saying, why don't you try Hong Kong? And so in India, at that time, I wasn't earning a lot of money. So I managed to save $500 in 3 years and get a plane ticket with the potential of getting an interview.
Okay.
Oh, good.
So you had sorry, I'm just going to go back a little bit. You had a straight guy in your bed all this time.
Yes. 6 months. And he's very authentically straight. It's definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So what did your mother think about this?
My mother was in South India, and it was just a friend. So any friend can share any bread. That's what Indian culture is. Sorry, bed. It's innocent.
That's very steadfast. It took 3 years to save up that money to go somewhere.
I wasn't intending to go to Hong Kong. It just happened. This friend of mine kept faxing me and calling me. I was working in a drug addiction center, and I was quite dedicated in what I did. He kept telling me, and then Ashok told me, better get out, just leave.
This is On Driven on Joy 94.9 with Kafam and Hugh.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9, this is On Driven with Kafam and Hugh, and our guest tonight is Ravi. Ravi comes from Mumbai in India, and before we played that song, we were talking about Hong Kong. But first, Ravi's going to tell us what the song was.
This song was from the first gay movie which had a really good relationship. This is called My Brother Nikhil. So the first part is in English. The next part will be in Hindi. It just is a movie which I cried and I cried because one of them had HIV. But it showed people who can love each other in a good light.
Nikhil is Indian, isn't it?
That's right.
Right, okay.
It's a very sweet, sickly song. I feel like I need to detox now. It's a good one. But
it's also a song from a partner who is telling the other one that whatever happens, I know you're going to die, but you know we'll still be together forever.
Oh, that's very sweet. Very, very sad song.
Moving on
Let's move on, yes. Now, we were talking about you getting $500, saving $500 over 3 years and going to Hong Kong because you had a friend who said you come to Hong Kong. So what did you do there?
Well, I got into staying with them for a while, and then I managed to get the interview, and I managed to find a job working with UNHCR with Vietnamese refugees.
What's just HCR?
United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
So you worked with what refugees did you work with?
The two kinds. Vietnamese refugees, before they came in 1988, were called refugees and they got asylum status. So they were basically allowed to resettle in countries like Australia. After 1988, they were called asylum seekers, which is what is now happening all around the world. And they had to prove they were refugees.
Right.
So they were locked up in prisons. And they had to wait for years to get a status determination. So I worked with both of them.
So what did you do? What was your
job? I worked as a social worker. And so when I started work, I worked in a camp where people had just arrived. And this was a little prison where there were 3,000 people locked in and basically lovely people, but they wanted freedom.
And, of course, you would need a interpreter, wouldn't you?
This was something I never understood in the beginning, which is basically I had to counsel or work with an interpreter. But
yes.
But after a while, once you get used to it, like you get used to talking in a show, you get used to it.
And most of these refugees were genuine?
When you say genuine, it is more political than anything else. So there is North Vietnam and there's South Vietnam. The people I was working with were mainly from North Vietnam. So somewhere the decisions change, and I think they were genuine, but they had to prove it. And how can you prove it when you don't have documents?
That's right. Now, my next question then is, were the people from North Vietnam different from the South Vietnamese? Or?
Culturally, I think because the way they speak, the accent's different. Like if I'm from North India, people will figure out because I look differently also and I speak differently. But if you say that my version of the North Vietnamese, I call them the Irish of the Asians because they make very good friends.
Okay.
They make very good hooch because they were making hooch there. And if you bet a bad enemy, then they'll make trouble with you.
They're making hooch.
Hooch is the alcohol which they were making inside rice. They were boiling and making good alcohol.
What were the conditions like in these camps?
It was subhuman. They were just basically stuck in very, very, very small crowded places, but they were very happy. I mean, I have not yet to meet people who are so happy, even though they were in these crowded conditions.
Mm.
They were happy just to be out of Vietnam.
They were happy because they were just being happy. That was the grace they have. It is a beautiful culture. It's such an incredible culture where they are friendly, they are loyal, and they are lovely people.
As a counselor, did you have to deal a lot with the children as well?
Yes, I had to deal with children. I had to deal with marital conflicts. If you put people together in a secluded place, there's problems. So I had to deal with I had to deal with the management because the police was managing these places.
Oh, okay, the Hong Kong police.
Yeah.
That's right. You mentioned that it's very difficult to prove your genuine status, and therefore a lot of them will be sent back if you can't prove it.
That's right.
And how did you feel about all that? Would have affected you to separate your personal life from work?
Working with the detention center was itself profoundly hard because once you finish at 5 o'clock, you get out of this prison and you go into Hong Kong, which is very different.
So bustling and
bustling and hustling, and you're having a drink in a gay bar and say hey. So that itself was difficult, and I think it was hard. But I was told by other people that this was probably better than if you were in a war torn country or if you're in a place which didn't have any facilities, because there are millions of refugees around the world staying there for years after years waiting for something they call and they value, which is called freedom.
The life must have been really tough, though. Did you come across any gay people in these camps?
Yes, I did. But again, Vietnamese culture is very simple, similar to most other Asian cultures. So the word there is very derogatory. It's something which is in French called bede.
Bede.
Yeah, which I think it's a bad word in French, but I'm not sure. But I was openly gay, so they accepted me. So I didn't at any point say, I told them I had when I got a relationship, I said I had a boyfriend. They accepted me, but they were not accepting of people within their community.
Did you said you were openly gay. Mm. Did that make people come to you and speak to you about being gay or?
Not very many people. Within the detention center, it was hard just to survive.
Mm.
And so it was not very... But with what we call the refugee centers, which is the other side I worked in, people who were refugees, but they had stayed there for 15 years and they got involved in taking drugs. And
15 years?
Yeah. They got waiting for being resettled.
That's a long time.
And they got involved in taking drugs and got criminal records and they couldn't leave.
There are similar camps in Malaysia as well. Were the Hong Kong refugee camps much different in terms of processing and allowing people to go through? Because I have met refugees in Australia, Vietnamese refugees who've been through Malaysia. They seem to process them a lot better.
The place I think was the most, there are different kinds of camps. There are camps which are communal. So there are camps in Philippines which people integrate with the local community. Mm-hmm. This is what we argue in Australia too. And there are prisons. A prison is a prison wherever you put it. And it's a shame that people get locked up just because they are refugees or seeking refuge. So I wouldn't call one prison or the other prison different. But yes, if you have people who are allowed to go within the community, meet other people, and be human beings, allowed to cook. For example, in the camps, they were not allowed to cook. They were cooking food which is pre-cooked, and they were just tossing it up. All your basic privileges in life.
So all the food was cooked for them?
It was pre-cooked food, which they then mixed up.
Right.
And so, every single privilege you can think of is taken away, and you have done nothing.
And then how long did you stay in that camp for?
I changed camps, and I moved depending on it. But in the end, I landed up with a refugee camp, which is because I work with drug addicts. So I started working with a camp called Pillar Point, which is a camp for refugees.
Okay. This is Orange Ribbon, and you're listening to Kafam and Hugh.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Literally by KK Joy 94.9 Orange Ribbon Multicultural Program with Hugh and Kafam. And our guest tonight is
Ravi.
Ravi. There's lots of thought there.
Ravi, tell us about the music.
Yes.
This is the longer version of the first song, and only in Hindi you have the capacity to take somebody around the moon and the stars and bring them back in 4 minutes. So basically what the song talks about is the fact of love is forever, and that wherever you are, whatever you do, whether it's the moon or the stars, it will always be there.
There's a common theme in the music thus far. It's about, you know, love lasting forever. Are you a real believer in, you know,
being... It's a romantic, I think.
You know, because people get break up and have divorces. Do you genuinely believe things can last for a long time?
Look, I've worked in this line, which is dealing in pain and suffering for so long with drug addicts, with people who have broken relationships, with people with the mental disorder, with refugees. There's this hope there, which is called spirituality, or there's this hope called love. I don't know what... it's a bad word if you were to hear it in a gay song or in a gay disco, but it's something more than just... the body.
So is this song dedicated to Peter?
This song is dedicated to anybody who's HIV positive. And
we have to say Peter isn't.
No, this song, the first song was Peter, and Peter is currently not positive,
but he's
quite negative most of the time. So
you'll get killed for that one. Anyway, let's move on a little bit. You met Peter in Hong Kong.
That's right.
And it caused a bit of a problem, didn't it? Because your actual position finished in Hong Kong.
Well, it was in terms of two men who love each other, there's always a problem of a passport in the middle. Actually, it's also the same for straight people, but it's more harder for us because we can't marry. So we can't just go to church or whatever it is and get a, you know, because even in Australia we can't do that yet.
Yeah.
And so I was stuck with a relationship which was very meaningful to me, and still I couldn't stay in Hong Kong. And I spoke to somebody who, because I was working with refugees, and so I was speaking to people in the Australian embassy, and they said, look, your skills are really good. You should be, you know, able to qualify. So I applied, mainly because I could then sponsor Peter.
But you went back to... You went back to university in Hong Kong, didn't you?
Yeah.
So you could stay there.
The first was we had to come up with something which we had to do to be able to live there. And my visa with the UN ran out. And either I moved to a UN career, which was attractive, but the relationship was more attractive. So I decided, I just wrote up a proposal and I got accepted to do a PhD in University of Hong Kong. That gave me a student visa.
Right. Right.
And after doing the PhD, does it guarantee you automatically?
No. Student visas don't give you anything. You're a student anywhere in the world and you don't get a residency.
So after the PhD, what was the plan? Did you have a plan?
No. The only plan was very short term. Be able to stay in Hong Kong and to be able to live with Peter and to be able to work, which I worked as a counselor. And that was it at that time. And then after that, to see how we could live together, which was in Australia.
Right. But you came to Australia first.
That's right.
And Peter was still working with Cathay Pacific.
That's right.
And there was a couple of problems, wasn't there, with Peter coming here?
Look, even though Australia is probably one of the most liberal countries in the world with regards to allowing people with the same sex, which you call de facto relationships, because anybody who lives for 365 days together is called a relationship. When I applied for sponsoring him, he had a big problem because we were honest. Being the only person who was staying with his family, he was staying with me for 5 days. We were living together. But for the weekends, like most Asian families, he was going home. And so when we declared that he was staying with me for 5 days and he was going home on Saturday, Sunday, he was not eligible.
Okay. So there's no gray matter, isn't
there? There's no gray matter.
It has to be black and white.
It's very black and white. It doesn't take into account people's culture and loyalties. And so we didn't know that. So the first time his application, which I sponsored, was rejected purely because he was going home to see his family.
Let's move on a little bit because... in your time here, you work as a counselor here, but you've written two articles for MCV. Now, the first one was on same-sex relationships.
Look, I feel very strongly about this because one of the things I've learned in Asia is that we have a community. It's very difficult there because it's against the law, but people have a lot of love and have a community. Okay. But in terms of same-sex
relationships, yeah.
I was trying to figure out what and how does it work.
Right.
So I asked a few people and I wrote that.
Let's come back to your article after this. This is Kafam and Hugh on Orange Ribbon.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Atif Islam with it has Joy 94.9 Orange Ribbon with Hugh and Kafam, our guest tonight. Ravi, I think Ravi's dying to say something on the mic. He's getting very close to the mic.
I was just listening to the song and getting lost in it. It's just a song, if you understand Hindi, where you get lost into being restless and finding truth.
And, of course, earlier we were talking about the article you've written on MCV about the same-sex relationships.
And I was shocking both of you because I said it's harder here to make a same-sex relationship than in a country like India where everything is against you. Because here, there is a thing called the scene. And in the scene, people go out, they enjoy, they feel good, but in the end, they wake up in the morning and they say next.
Next, okay.
And so, of course, the internet would have made it compounded the problem.
The internet has, in some ways, made it easier and in some ways made it harder. It made it easier, at least you can declare that you're looking for a relationship instead of just going through this whole thing of a sauna or a gay bar. But again, you still need to meet people and get to know them. So you can't really do that sitting in your keyboard.
In your job as a counselor, do you deal a lot with same-sex couples?
I deal with some. A little bit of my job is with same-sex couples.
Right. And have you run any courses or any seminars?
We do have a group called the Coming Out or Questioning Group, which we run every semester, which is really because there is this whole scene out there, but there are people in Australia from the country who live in colleges or basically are terrified and questioning. One of the saddest ones I heard was a young man who basically said, look, all I want is to make some friends. And whenever I go out, all I find is people who want to have sex with me.
And so what was his problem?
His problem was that he wanted to feel good about himself out and feel a sense of connection and call it friendship and be comfortable with that. But he was just jumped into, you know, the whole sexuality and having sex.
Right. This might come across me, you know, batting for the side of Asia, because as far as I know, when there's a foreigner in our country, we go out of our way to welcome that person, to make them feel at home. Whereas when I first got here to my campus, there was literally all Caucasian, and I was terrified. But then I was also very lonely because no one came to me and said, "Hi, you know, this is my name, rah rah rah, you know, welcome, we'll take you around."
That's more a reflection of how cultures collide. And in that sense, in this culture, we like space and we respect and we expect you to take initiative. Whereas in an Asian culture, we kind of crowd you and we kind of move. So when I go back, you know, I feel crowded because that's what love is. So it's for most people who come here, it's to understand that you need to take initiative. If you don't do that, this society, which is fantastic, doesn't, you know, just leaves you alone because they presume that you've got to take the initiative.
So you have to have that little inner spark of initiative to go out of your way. Otherwise, you will sink.
Yeah, or you'll withdraw and you'll feel that people don't like you.
This is Orange Ribbon on Joy 94.9 with Kafam and Hugh. And our guest tonight is Ravi. And Ravi's a counsellor at Melbourne University. And thank you, Kafam. And we're talking about articles he wrote for MCV. And the second one that you wrote, Ravi, was the one on the Indian High Court repealing Section 377. So tell us a little bit about this.
I got a call from Vivek, who's from the Humsafar Trust, who excitedly told me, we are free! And he said, what was going on? And basically, what was going on was really exciting because for many hundreds, the law was in 1860, and it was the old sodomy law, which was repealed everywhere. Daspani was the last one in Australia, but it was repealed, but it's still valid in India, which means that two men who have sex can be sent to prison. And that's that's why I went to actually Hong Kong, because in 91 the sodomy law in Hong Kong was repealed. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this has been repealed in a small, I'm sorry, it's a big city, it's a capital city in Delhi. Mm-hmm. And if that goes through, it would mean changes, which means we'll be catching up with other parts of the mm-hmm. world.
Surely police would have abused that law in the past to get bribery or, you know, due to corruption.
There's a whole lot of things going on behind the law. There's discrimination, but most importantly, there is this invisibility. You are invisible. You do not exist. So if you are same-sex attracted, you do not exist in India. If this law is repealed, it would allow people like in Australia and like in other parts of the world to take the first step towards saying, we are there.
Mm. Do you reckon as a consequence of this, you know, do you reckon saunas and this kind of discourse will start creeping up?
Well, that's what happened in Hong Kong. After this law was repealed, we suddenly had the pink dollar, which suddenly the marketing people or the entrepreneurs started to see. But most importantly, what my friend said is you can hold hands. Okay, in a small ghetto or in a small area, but you can hold hands and you can be visible. And obviously, if you have money, you can spend it.
In India, though, it is quite normal for guys to walk down the street and have their arm run about each other and be very friendly, isn't it?
And also to sit on each other's lap, and that's very common as well.
That is common, and that doesn't make them gay. Mm-hmm. I mean, No. My joke was I could have sex with five guys, but they're not gay. They're not gay. They're just in the night we're playing with each other. And the fact is that you can come out and say you are somebody who mm-hmm. likes men mm-hmm. or women or transgender is really important.
In Delhi, is there any gay bars at the moment? Is there any gay venues?
There are venues which open up on the weekends, but mostly they're parties, they're private parties which are held. And in Delhi, of course, there's a whole diplomatic circle out there, but there are what you call internal scenes. Like here we have external ones, there we have internal ones. But if you go in, you'll find lots of activity.
But there must be, like every other country, there must be beats and everything else. And
beats are very common.
Yeah? Is this because of the laws that they have across?
It's also because of space, because most people live with their families and they live, you know, in a culture where they don't have their own space.
Not that I expect you to know this piece of information, because people get bashed up in beats and robbed. Would be the same case in India, wouldn't it?
It's more.
More, even more.
Much more, because if you are, say, middle class, if you're going to beats, you kind of take it as part and parcel of what's going to happen.
So when you go back to India, do you feel different? Do you feel that you can't be yourself? Or?
Well, I feel honored and I feel really happy because I have a community there. But there are many Indians there who don't know this community. Mm. And this community has really grown. So if you know somebody and you know somebody, by the time you get a connection, I can go any part of India and meet people who are gay.
Right. And, you know, because as a result of this act being repealed, do you reckon more and more boys and girls will become more visible now openly? And well, the parents, it could actually literally threaten the structure of the Indian family values?
I don't know if it'll threaten it or it'll add to it, because my dream is that if this law is passed all over India, it'll show Western cultures what relationships are, because Western cultures tend to go out and celebrate sexuality, but in relationships seem to struggle. But most Asian cultures, like my mother got married to a photograph, my father.
Mm-hmm.
So they tend to, once you get into a relationship, the relationship is really the most important thing that drives Asian cultures. So I think if in India this happens, it will allow people to get married, it will allow people to be together.
Let's move on a little bit about your counselling, your job here in Melbourne. We were talking about people questioning their sexuality. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. This is something which is really important for me and for a lot of people. It's this whole issue of coming out or questioning, because there's a spectrum out there. It's not either gay or not gay. For example, I had a woman who contacted me who said she is lesbian, but she's interested in a guy. Mm. And, you know, if I took a classical mold, I would be in trouble. But the question of questioning is really important when you're young.
Just one question there. Would you call that person bisexual?
I don't know of this context here, but in my opinion, whatever little I know, not necessarily with this woman, but if you are in a relationship, that is what your sexuality is, not who you have sex with. So you can have sex with a variety of people, and you can experiment, especially if you're young. You know, when you're young, you're horny. You don't basically think about anything else. But it is about...
I know the feeling, actually.
Yes, I love you. We are old, remember. It's about you, who you want to get up in the morning and make breakfast to. It's about who you want to hold hands and feel that this is the person I want to live with.
So your definition of a bisexual person is someone who would actually be willing to have a relationship, not just to have a screw.
That's right.
And then say, okay, I'm bisexual.
And it doesn't matter to that person whether it's a male or female.
Is it quite common for people to question their sexuality?
When you are between 16 to 22, 21, I think even when you're 12, it's quite common to experiment.
Right.
And in that experimenting, sometimes there's confusion because you feel scared, you have doubts. So if you don't question it, it's like saying every straight guy doesn't have sex with guys. I'm sorry, that we all know that's not true.
So what you're actually saying, if there's a 15-year-old guy sitting out there listening to us at the moment, and he doesn't know what way he wants to go, he has feelings for a guy, feelings for a woman, and just go and experiment?
Well, I wouldn't tell him to experiment. He would do it by himself. But I would tell him to talk to people, ask around, and see what he feels about it. Mm. And in that feeling, to see what feels right for him. And what feels right for him is what he should think about, not what the world tells him.
Right. Because do you get a lot of young people at the university coming to you and saying, well, look, what should I do? You know, what way can I go?
I've got a few people terrified, and in that fear, they come out with different presentations. So it could be somebody who's questioning. It could be somebody who just woke up in the morning after he had sex with his best friend and that says, oh, does that make me gay? which is an old one. But then you start saying, okay, what does that mean to you? How do you feel about it? Where are you coming from? And then he processes and what comes out where he feels about it.
And do you run, a lot of our you work with international students, right?
That's right.
And because a lot of international students, when they first arrived here, they haven't really explored their sexuality. Do you run workshops for them on their sexuality, perhaps?
We don't necessarily run workshops for international students. What we do is offer things which we feel are relevant, and some of them come maybe international students. But on a one-on-one basis, we do see some students who are, say, for example, from Pakistan or from China, and the whole issue there for them, it's like, yes, if I am coming out here, but I have to go home.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the show, Ravi.
And we must have Ravi back soon to talk about sexuality.
There's so much that we would love to talk to you about tonight. But that's On Driven for another week, Ravi. But thank you for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Joy 94.9 is Paul and Simon with Global Sound. Thanks for joining us on Driven tonight. We'll be back again at the same time, 7 p.m. next Wednesday, with more insights into our GLBT multicultural community here in Australia and around the world. Thanks to Nick on reception for his help tonight, from Kafam, and myself, Hugh. Good night.
Good night.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.